Okay, thank you. So we have our second talk today by Martin Sommer from the Austrian Central Bank. So Martin has been a pioneer in a lot of these in this literature on network models and systemic risk. He did some very early work on that, and he continues to produce interesting work on topics related to systemic risk and regulation. So please, Martin.
Thanks a lot, Rama, for the kind introduction. Thanks a lot for inviting me. In a way, this presentation is continuing the main topics of Tobias' talk before. And the focus is endogenous leverage and asset pricing, and why there is also this term, strange perhaps term, double auction, you will see when I talk about it. In a way, what we are doing in this paper, which is, by the way, a joint work with Thomas Breuer, Martin Jandatschka, and Hans-Joachim Vollbrecht. Thomas is sitting here in the audience, is that Tobias was stressing that we know a lot of stylized facts about the crisis and how the financial system works. And he said, let's go and construct a model that matches these facts. This is great, but if you have done that, you are still interested in the question is that, okay, is my model, it's matching the facts, but is it providing an appropriate perspective? What's the mechanisms that drive this match? And what we are doing is really, we try to devise a methodology or an approach that can say something about the mechanisms behind these models and how we can validate them. This is the philosophy. So we want to understand recent theories of leverage and asset pricing from a different perspective, if you want. So specifically, what we do in this paper is we study the exchange and the pricing of leveraged assets in what you could call, or what could be called, an agent-based model of a continuous double auction, and I will explain what this means. Specifically, we asked two concrete questions. First, how is leverage determined in the market? So we really want to understand the deeper parameters that determine leverage. Second, how does leverage affect asset prices? So the ultimate goal is we want to understand whether recent advances in economic theory that answer these questions theoretically actually provide an appropriate perspective in the sense that I told you before. Now, let me clarify some jargon before I go into the presentation, because leverage is used in different meanings in the literature. So what do we mean here when we talk about leverage? If you purchase, say, a house worth 100 and borrow 80 using the house as collateral and putting 20 down in the transaction, we say that the loan-to-value ratio is 80% in this transaction, the margin is 20%, the collateral rate is 125%, the leverage is 5, because your down payment is multiplied by 5 in the value of the house. These are all different ways of saying the same thing. It's just expressed in different ratios. So the question in this, that the theory tries to attempt to answer, is how are these ratios determined and how does this affect asset prices? So leverage here is really, and this is perhaps also important as a footnote, it's thinking about margin. So it's the leverage you can get on new lending. How much can you borrow against a particular asset to purchase it? Whereas leverage as a ratio of debt equity over total assets in the balance sheet is somehow a stock measure from everything that happened in the past. So this is the thing we are talking about in leverage in this sense. So why is an answer to these questions interesting, and why it is important in the context of systemic risk, the topic of the conference that concerns us here? I would say there are three reasons. First, higher leverage makes agents more sensitive to changes in asset prices. This is the risk source, basically. Leverage is intimately connected to asset price bubbles, and I would say that leverage is a key driver of systemic risk. Many concepts we are talking about in systemic risk come together or really boil down to leverage issues. So this is the connection to systemic risk. Now, let me spend a slide on the theory literature and give you a little bit on a perspective of which theory we are particularly interested in, because economists are great in building many different theories that contradict each other and have lots of details, and we have to sort this out a little bit before. The traditional literature on collateralized lending, I gave here two classical references, Bernanke, Gertler, and Gilchrist from the macro literature, the financial accelerator literature, Kiyotaki and Moore, which is about credit cycle. They were already interested in this mechanism that you lend or borrow against collateral. But this theory could not explain leverage. Leverage there is a parameter. You have this house, say, as a collateral, and of course if the house increases in value, you can get more credit, but the ratio you can borrow against the value of the house, the leverage stays constant. But we want to have a theory that explains this ratio and the variation in it, because we know from the data and from the financial crisis that this is a very important thing. Giannakopoulos and Same and John Giannakopoulos suggest new ideas that are able to explain this leverage ratio. And this is therefore a theory we are very much interested in. And I do not go so far that I am saying that this is the only theory to explain leverage endogenously, but one of the few. It's only competing perhaps in terms of explaining leverage endogenously with the literature in corporate finance connected to Holmstrom and Tyrol. And perhaps with some other papers, this literature is more moving very fast. But the Giannakopoulos and Same theory, among all these theories, is our favorite and our benchmark. Let me say two arguments why this is the case. The corporate finance literature, the Holmstrom and Tyrol literature, is very rich in richer than the general equilibrium theory in micro details. It's a lot about asymmetric information, lots of details on the mechanism, but it is partial equilibrium. So the other theory, the Giannakopoulos theory, is more parsimonious. It's not so rich in micro detail, but it captures the general equilibrium, the interaction effects more deeply, and this is why we start with this theory. So this will be the theory we look at. And we like this theory as a theory, but we want to know, does it give you an appropriate perspective? Is it more than just logically or theoretically compelling or not? Now comes the mysterious term double auction. You might ask me, give me any market where leverage assets are traded in double auctions, and I cannot give you any. So the point of the double auction background is not the point of realistically modeling how these assets are traded, but something else. We have here a simulation study, and like in a human subject experiment, we try to understand institutions and processes behind the abstract theory. And we take as a starting point a market institutions that we understand very well. And the double auction is, from the experimental economics literature and from the literature, such a mechanism. Remember that the purpose is really like we want to understand, does this theory work in an environment that we understand very well? And then can we explain why it works there or why it does not work there? And therefore the environment is stylized because we want to understand the environment very well. This is the double auction starting point. By the way, I should say that this is a simulation study, which is very, in flavor, very similar to an experiment. And Thomas and I are actually involved in doing such an experiment, which we have not done yet. And therefore, the double auction is an institution you would use in an experimental setup, and therefore we are also interested in. It helps to understand, we believe, the key elements that make this theory work in practice and to gauge the scope of its applicability. And that's the point of the double auction thing. Now, let me say, before I go into the details, talk about what I believe are the main contributions we can make by this approach first. While the double auctions have been studied for a long time in experimental economics, double auction for leveraged assets are new, and we discuss a little bit how a double auction for this environment would work, and therefore prepare a bit of the ground for putting this to an actual experiment. Second contribution, the institutions of exchange that matter most for whether this theory provides a good perspective or not are two things. First, are there good coordination institutions between the market for collateral and the market for the financial instruments? Second, are there institutions that allow getting in and out of trades quickly? And we will talk about this, what this means. If you have these kind of institutions, the theory will, albeit it's very abstract and forgets a lot of things, be quite spot on predicting what's going on, otherwise not. So we analyze also, and this is the third contribution, when the endogenous leverage theory, according to Giannakopoulos and Same, reaches its limits. So these are the three things. So these are our main findings, and then I go into the details. So we find that, first of all, we find evidence that the theory is a valid and appropriate framework if debt instruments are traded on competitive markets with functioning institutions coordinating collateral and debt markets. Second, these markets provide institutions that allow for swift reversibility of trades. There's no restrictions on trade between arbitrary agents, and collateral assets provide no direct utility. So if you think about this requirement list, you would say perhaps the Giannakopoulos theory is a pretty good theory for repo. For houses, you would perhaps think again. Or for other instruments. So this is what we find in a nutshell. So how do we find this? And this is what I want to explain in my talk. And before I can do that, let me first walk you very quickly through the bones and nuts and bolts of the theory through a very stylized example that is due to John, and which gave us the idea in the first place that you could put this to an experimental test, because in order to do this, you really have to boil down a theory to a very, very simple setup. Like calculating it overnight by hand, that was Tobias' criterion, is not sufficient. You really have to be able to calculate it basically on the back of an envelope if you want to do an experimental test. So the general equilibrium theory of leverage and asset pricing we study in the paper is due to Giannakopoulos and Same, I said this. There are two key properties of collateral equilibrium emphasized by this theory. The mechanism in the theory how leverage is explained endogenously is a contract selection mechanism. So the key idea really is that the market in principle provides lots of opportunities to exchange debt contracts, but in equilibrium only a few of them will be actively used, and by that leverage is varying. Second, the theory finds that there are collateral premia in equilibrium assets that can be used as collateral for debt instruments trade at the premium above their fundamental value. But this is a property shared also with the older literature. I mean, as soon as you have a collateral constraint on an underlying asset, of course, if you think about the optimization problem where this constraint is binding, you have one term for the present value plus something else. And these premia pop up here. So the really innovative part is this contract selection part in Giannakopoulos and Same. So this is the example. It's very stylized and very simple. Think about the real side of this economy as follows. There is an exchange economy with two dates and two states, the up and down state. There is only one consumption good. And in these units of the consumption goods, it's the numeraire, every values are expressed in the units of this consumption good. Agents care about the sum of consumption today and the expected consumption tomorrow. And there is a real asset which pays one unit of the consumption good in the upstate and one in the downstate. Think of it as a tree, the consumption good as apples. And these agents are endowed with one consumption good and one tree, one real asset. And the agents have names, and you can arrange these names in the unit interval in a continuum from 0 to I. And if your name is 1, you are absolutely sure that the upstate will occur tomorrow, so you are a super optimist. If your name is 0, you believe that for sure the downstate will come tomorrow, and then you have anything in between. So you have heterogeneity in beliefs about the states which create motives to trade apples and trees in this economy. Let me say as a footnote, this is not the essential thing that you frame it in a story of belief heterogeneity. What matters is that you have heterogeneity in the marginal utility of consumption across states, which can come from other sources. There is a market structure. It's assumed that today there is a competitive market for the trees, for the real asset, and for a set of bonds. And now, the bond is a financial instrument that allows the agents to borrow and lend, basically. And it has two characteristics. First, and this is like in the traditional literature, there is a face value, which is say like, it's a fixed promise to repay across the state if you borrow through this bond. And there is a second thing going with the bond, is a collateral requirement. And each unit borrowed by selling or issuing the bond has to be backed up by a tree, by a real asset you hold in your portfolio as a collateral. So there is a restriction that couples the financial markets and the collateral markets through this collateral requirement. Now, the use of this, the role of this collateral, of course, is to secure the promises made through the financial instruments. And the assumption here is that the most a borrower can lose when not honoring his financial promise is losing the collateral. This is the only consequence of the default. He does not go to jail, he has no other consequences. And thus the borrower always delivers the minimum of the promised amount and the collateral value tomorrow. And vice versa, the lenders always receive the minimum between the promised amount and the collateral value. So this makes sure that these promises or collateralized assets can be anonymously exchanged because nobody cares about the identity of the partners in the market, and the collateral value is really what matters in these transactions. So, and this is the basic idea in Giannakopoulos and Same, the economic idea, how they explain leverage endogenously, because they say credit is a multidimensional thing. It's the face value and the collateral, and you have a priori a whole range of opportunities. Every pair of face value and collateral is economically something different and has a different price. But in equilibrium, perhaps not all of these opportunities are actively traded. The individuals, when they take the decision in the theory, have three sorts of constraints. They cannot short the trees, the real assets. They have to respect the collateral requirement. So if they issue a financial promise, they have to keep the real asset in store as collateral. They have to respect their budget constraints, of course. And then you have a very standard notion of a competitive equilibrium, which is called a collateral equilibrium, which is a collection of prices, consumption plans, planned holding of the real asset, and bonds, such that each agent has maximized his utility and that the market for goods, real assets, and financial promises is clear. And this is what the equilibrium predicts, basically, structurally. It says that it splits in two cases. If the a priori opportunities for financial markets trading include a risk-free bond, then while all bonds are traded and priced in equilibrium, all borrowing and lending takes place via the risk-free instrument in this example. And the real asset earns a collateral premium. So these are the two predictions. The first is the contract selection part. So say if the real asset promises 1 in the up state and 0.2 in the down state, a risk-free promise will promise 0.2 and 0.2 in both states. You might have another bond that promises 0.5 and 0.5, which would default in the down state. It has a price in equilibrium, but it will not be traded. This is what the theory predicts here in this example. If you have no risk-free bonds, it's a little bit more complicated, but basically, structurally, it's the same. While all bonds are priced in equilibrium, not traded, all borrowing and lending takes place via the least risky bond only. All real assets turn a collateral premium, also lower than in the market structure with the riskless bond. So there is a contract selection and an asset pricing implication in it. So this is how, in this simple example of John, the equilibrium allocation looks like. You have here the names of all the agents listed up from the most pessimistic to the most optimistic one. And because they have these linear preferences, consumption today plus expected consumption tomorrow, you have here a cutoff, a marginal agent that is indifferent between buying this asset or selling it. Those who are more optimistic, they want to buy it even if they have to lever up. So they would issue bonds and put collateral against these bond issues to get as much as possible of the real assets. And there are pessimists who don't think the asset is worth anything, who are happy to sell these assets. And there, this is how the allocation looks like. If you have a risk-free bond available, if you have no risk-free bond, then you have two marginal agents, but structurally it's the same. So now, this is what the theory says. Now we want to understand through the double auction, how does this theory work? How does it work when I apply it? How does it work when I apply it to a market? Of course, a real market is much too complicated for us. So we want first to understand the double auction market. And we want to put this in a double auction environment. I will now explain what this means, which has exactly the same parameters as this example. And we would say like endowments, beliefs, and the trees, and everything is in there. And we want to know, okay, in this environment, if we would apply this abstract theory, does it give me a correct prediction? Yes or no, and why not, and what are the critical factors driving that? Now, let me first walk you through the double auction, how it functions, the actual trading mechanism, and it will contain some peculiar assumptions which are not completely clear when I explain it, and then afterwards, give you in a slide the rationale why we do it like this, and then go from there. Yes?
So what are I1 and I2?
I1 is the name of the agent who is indifferent between holding cash and holding a bond. I2 is the name of the agent who is indifferent between the real asset and the bonds. And here, I star is the agent that is indifferent between buying and selling the real asset. Okay, so this is the trading institutions for our simulation. There are three simultaneous types of markets. There is an asset for consumption, we call it loosely cash, the numeraire is cash market. Bonds for various types of bonds for cash, and this is not there in the theory. There is also a market where you can directly swap assets against bonds without going through cash. In the theory, this is no issue. If you write down the abstract equilibrium theory, all markets are available all the time. In all relations, it doesn't matter. But here you have to pin it down. Second, of course, we do not have a continuum in the real world, so we populate this interval discretely with a number of 1,000 agents in our simulation, equidistantly distributed among the unit interval from 0 to 1. And then there is a bidding. This is why it's called an auction. An agent is picked at random, and this agent submits both buy and sell offers to the order book. So he can go to this order book and say, I sell a particular unit of the tree for this price, or I want to buy this for this price, and for the bonds and everything else too. Now, how do these agents do that? You have to give them some goals. In John's theory, they are utility maximizers, and they optimize. Here we have something else. Here we have the goals of the agent specified, as it's called in this agent-based literature, sometimes zero intelligence agents. So they are not very sophisticated. They have no memory. They do not look too much in the future. But they are not really zero intelligence, because it's a little bit the misnomer of the literature. They do utility improving bids. But beyond that utility improving, the bidding is random. In this sense, they are... And these are limit orders, so they are fixed units. So you only make price offers for a particular unit to buy and sell.
You can have multiple units. You could put in a quote of 12 units at one price and 10 at another.
Yeah. Now, but you have to do this in a sequence. So one bid is, can only be made in parcels, so you can...
Right. You update your...
Yes. Now, each offer that is made in the market has to satisfy these constraints that make sure that the budget constraint and the collateral constraint is fulfilled, and that the asset cannot be sold short. But we put one additional assumption here, which is also critical. In John's and Bill's theory, only the real asset can be a collateral, the tree. Here we relax this assumption a little bit, which is, this is something we call bond pledgeability. So if you want to free a real asset that has been already pledged in the process as collateral, you can do this by having a bond position that is positive. I learned recently from the literature, we call it bond pledgeability, but there is a technical term to it called pyramiding. So you can not only put the collateral itself, the asset itself as collateral, but also positive bond positions. Ultimately, every promise is then backed by a collateral, but the constraint is less strict. And I will give you a reason why this is so. And now, this market is very dynamic. It starts, and then these agents jump in and make offers, bids, and asks, and this is written in these order books. And when these offers match, if they provide a beneficial trade, a trade is executed, and the profit of this trade is split according to some rule. And this goes on over time and over time, and with a lot of randomness in it. And this process continues until there is no transactions made in the last 1,000 rounds. Now, before I say something about the rationale, this is a mechanism that somehow reaches an equilibration after some point, always. It's not straightforward why this is the case, but you can understand it. So this would already give us a first hint, which is interesting, because Tobias said we need an equilibrium theory to look at this. But of course, you can ask, is equilibrium an appropriate perspective to look at these markets? Or you might look something else. Here you have some equilibration process going on. So here, it's not completely off if you think about what you see in this double auction in terms of equilibrium, at least after the convergence state. Now, let me say a little bit about this mechanism. So, I mean, if you go through the steps, you realize this is a fairly standard double auction, but it has two peculiar features. One is we have this swap market, where you trade assets directly against bonds without going through the cash. And we have this pyramiding assumption in there. So if you think about such a mechanism, you see that you must solve two things in this leveraged asset trade. So one is really you have a coordination need between the collateral market and the bond market. Think about like buying a house on leverage. Of course, to buy the house, you need to borrow. But to get the credit, you need to have the house as collateral, which you do not have yet. You need some coordination for this. But also in the other markets. So there is an issue here. And you have to think in a real world institution how this is resolved exactly, this coordination, how it is done. Second, the equilibrium theory is a static theory. It's just like you have resource constraints, you have optimal plans, and then you're looking for prices that make this all consistent. There is no process in between. So this question is, how do I get in and out of trades, does not arise in the equilibrium theory. But in a process, of course, that's going on over time, you need to think about this, because you start making bids to the order book, and then you have pledged a certain amount of assets, but then perhaps then another opportunity comes along and you want to unpledge and buy something else, and you need an institution how to get in and out of trades quickly. So in a process, in a real world trading institutions, these issues have to be addressed. So our solution to problem two, getting in and out of trade, is this assumption of bond pledgeability or pyramiding.
When you say solution, are you looking at this from a design perspective, or are you looking at this as some way of understanding how the collateral market works?
For understanding how what needs to be there to make it work, it's a little bit mixed. I cannot give a clear answer whether it's a design perspective or how it should work. It's a little bit of finding out what is really needed to make. What are the essential features to make this theory work in a practical environment? So getting in and out of trade in our mechanism is solved by this bond pledgeability assumption. So if you want to unpledge an asset, it's enough if you buy a bond. The net effect on the collateral is zero, and we call this bond pledgeability. The second is, how are these markets coordinated? You can think about various coordination mechanisms for coupled trades. So coupled conditional offers would, for instance, be a solution. A conditional offer would mean I give a price bid to buy a real asset conditional on getting a loan in the other market. And if both conditions are fulfilled, the transaction is executed. However, there is a subtlety in there in practice. This is something that coordinates markets, but if you think about the utility improvement calculation behind it, there is an issue. It's like much more restrictive if you have separate utility improvement in each of the coupled trades is more restrictive than a net sum of utility improvement over all coupled trades. And this swap market somehow achieves this comprehensive view and is less complex than a conditional offer market. This is why we have it in there. Now, we call these features asset and bond market ABM. Now, so this is how it looks like. Now, I show you what the simulation brings you, and then I conclude. We study now four questions. We first ask, do transaction prices converge? I should put this in inverted commas, so it's not a very precise terminology. Do they converge during the double order? Is there some kind of equilibration in this process? And if there is, I would say at least for the double auction or for likewise environment, thinking about what's going on there in terms of equilibrium is not a completely far-fetched or completely at odds with this market. Second, if prices do converge to something, are the limit prices close to the theoretical prices predicted by the theory given the parametrization? Because, I mean, they might converge, they might equilibrate, but do something completely different. And I ask also, is the final allocation, in a sense, close to the equilibrium allocation? And then last, we ask, do we observe contract selection in the double auction as predicted by the theory? Let me say as a footnote also, these are, for instance, questions you can only answer in such a kind of setting or in an experimental setting. For instance, if you would ask, does it make sense to think about, say, repo prices I observe as resulting from an equilibrium? You have no chance to decide this from the field data. They are just there for some reason. But here you can like see from the institution, does this work? But also contract selection is something you could never decide from field data. But here you can give a menu of contract and say, okay, I observe really that the market mechanism I have put into place in my simulation indeed selects among these contracts. So it's somehow not a complete nonsense to think about endogenous leverage in terms of contract selection. So this is why we are interested in this kind of approach, which might seem unusual because you don't see it so often, except perhaps in experimental economics. So these are the questions we ask. And of course, you have lots of randomness in these processes. You can only give an answer in somehow in a statistical sense. So we run 30 of these double auctions and look at averages across these runs. And then we devise certain indicators to answer these questions. So for the equilibration, do the prices converge? We ask, we have a convergence indicator, and we look at somehow the proportions of auctions where we have what we call approximate price convergence, which means that the standard deviations of the transaction price over the last 1,000 trades to the average does not go beyond the threshold. This is what our understanding of equilibration in this market. The second, for the price convergence, we look at the relative error between the transaction prices over the last 1,000 transactions and the theoretically predicted. And for the allocations, we devise a similar measure where we look across all these asset classes, cash, trees, and bonds, and somehow aggregate the deviation from the equilibrium. So that, the relative deviation. So this is how I read now the tables that I show you. But don't worry, I go through them slowly. Also, I reach my time limit. So what you see here is a first slide that is summarizing the simulation result on prices and allocations. And what you see here above are the prices as predicted by the theory. So the price of the real asset of the tree, in this example, where we have this continuum of agent, everybody has one apple and one tree as an endowment, and you have these markets, would be this. So this is the price of the real asset, this is the price of the riskless bond, and this is the asset and bond relative price as predicted by the theory. For a bond with a face value 0.2, remember this is the riskless bond because the asset had 1 and 0.2. If you have a risky asset like 0.5, you also get the price and for the bond and for the real asset and for the asset and bond relative price. So this is what the theory would predict. Now this is the final outcome in the simulated double auction with ABM and bond pledgeability as I explained it to you. So you see here, if you have the bond with a face value 0.2, this is the theoretical price, and this is the price, the final price in the simulation, and this is the standard deviation. And you see the price error, so it has convergence in almost all the auctions. the price error is not too big and the allocation error is also quite small, and you can do this for a risky bond. But now for us there are two interesting things. Remember that we have put these two things, ABM and bond pledgeability, to the mechanism. Now we can show that in the simulation that both of these features are in somehow necessary for the theory to make a correct prediction, in the sense that if you leave either of them, so you do the same mechanism but drop the swap market, or you do the same mechanism but don't allow bond pledgeability, then you get something which is far more of the equilibrium. You see in prices the errors, the price error is now much bigger, from 2 to 8%, the allocation error is increasing, you don't get convergence all the time, and this is the same without bond pledgeability. Now you might say, okay, I mean these are very, very special institutions and they have to do with the zero intelligence agents, because more sophisticated agents might don't need these institutions perhaps. But that's exactly the point. If you think about a theory and whether it's applicable in the real world, you have to say, does it work for the people who are actually active in this market? And these people here are not optimizing, they are utility improving. So this puts certain restrictions, and of course they don't make optimal plans. But still the theory works if the mechanism is intelligent enough, which is somehow fascinating. And then you can ask yourself following questions then perhaps, if you apply this theory to say the repo market or any other market, does it have institutions that fulfill these roles that you know from the simulation will be critical that the theory is applicable, yes or no? And it gives you a feeling, what's the gauge of this theory? It's not a scientific proof that says like you can only apply this for repo, but it adds a little bit of our understanding, when does this really very, very abstract theory possibly work or not. Now here I have the same slide with the second basic prediction of the theory, the endogenous leverage or contract selection thing. And you see here the same thing. In the theoretical equilibrium you have a complete contract selection. The theory predicts with the riskless bond, if you have a riskless bond and say a more risky bond in principle available a priori, in equilibrium only the riskless bond will be used. Now of course here we have some noise and it's not sharp, but you have something like this as well. It's also fascinating because remember that everything here is a lot of randomness is going in. If somebody decides to issue a bond or to take a loan, he does not do a calculation, should I use the 0.5 or 0.2, it just picks randomly. But the market mechanism is such that the transactions that are going on with the riskless have a much higher chance to succeed, and it's like in an evolutionary selection, somehow they will be chosen by the market. And if you drop either ABM or BP, the contract selection also breaks down. So these seem to be somehow critical institutions in this kind of context. I'm reaching the end of my time, so I won't not go into the details of... we do some robustness analysis in the paper, which wiggles around with all the parameters that are in there. Distribution of pessimists and optimists, distributions of initial endowments, and all kinds of things. And you see these pictures, somehow they do not dramatically look different. We also look into the limits of the double auction. When does the theory break down completely, despite of ABM and BP? It's very interesting to go into this, but I don't have time. Let me just say a key word about this. What seems to be critical is really that the trading between any pair of agents is not restricted. As soon as you think about intermediated trade, something we discussed before, that I can say I can exchange my things with Laurent, but to exchange with Chris I have to go via Thomas. then it doesn't work. That's completely different results. We have also a part in the paper which explain these things that might seem quite mysterious to you about the convergence of the double auction, how it works exactly. Actually, a lot of this can be understood very precisely. Why it must converge, how it works, why the allocation looks like this. So lots of things can be explained. I cannot go into the details. So let me skip these slides and go to the conclusions. Whether the outcome of a double auction mechanism is predicted well by the theory of John and Bill depends crucially on the institutional details of exchange. It's the first insight. Specifically, institutions that allow to reverse trades flexibly, as well as institutions that allow a good coordination between debt and collateral markets, seem to be crucial, and both features we could show in this simulation seem to be critical. Only if these institutional details are appropriately implemented by the mechanism, we can hope for a good match between the theory and the double auction. And this is all I have to say at this stage. So thank you very much.
So we have time for some questions.
Could you say a bit more about how these the bids get put into the market? So the agent could say, well, I'd be happy to buy 500 of this at a tiny price. Well, that's surely not what's going to happen. How does it get done?
It gets done in the following way. So the auction gets started. Then agents are picked in a random order, and they can submit bids or ask to the order book on all the open markets. This means on the asset markets, on the bond markets, and on perhaps the swap market if it's open or not. Then, and what they put to the order book are limit order. They say, I want to buy or want to sell X units of tree or the bond or something at this price. And it's put in the order book. And so all this is...
How are X and P chosen? How does the agent pick X and P?
Well, we have a limit order, so we have fixed this unit. The units are not chosen. So you give them a fixed unit. So you can only put bids for units of a given size.
Sure, but I mean, at what price do I put it in?
Yeah, the price is my bid. And then I say, like, I want to buy this, for instance, at the price such and such. And other agents come in, this is all going on simultaneously, and say, I want to sell at this price. And if there are two offers in this book that allow an advantage...
What are the distributional assumptions? What's the mechanism? Because if everybody puts in very, very high asked and there's low bids, there's no crossing and nothing ever happens.
Yes, but there is lots of transactions going on if you do this.
For each agent has a certain degree of optimism, and this belief gives a limit price. And so, for example, if he wants to sell, he wants to have at least this. Everything above this price is utility improving for him, and he picks a random price above it from a uniform distribution.
This is very important. That's it, because, like, if you're an optimist and you want to make a sell offer for this asset, and say you are 0.8, you only prices that are consistent with your, this is the, because you're completely right, if you would have no restrictions like this, no conversion, nothing would happen. But here what's happening, of course, and what's driving convergence is, if you think about it, you have these pessimistic and these optimistic agents, and then of course the agents who are most far apart in terms of optimism and pessimism have the highest chance of a successful match in the beginning. So they go out of the market first, and then, you know, this is somehow driving the convergence process. But this is discussed quite a bit in detail in the paper if you're interested in it. So my guess from this would say that if you tell me that look at the repo interbank market through John and Bill's theory, I would feel very comfortable. If you tell me, let's look at the housing market, I would not feel as comfortable. Yeah. I would say I need a little bit more, perhaps, thinking about when this applies.
So here you say it's the institutional details of exchange are very important, but there's no intermediary in your model. That's an institutional detail, which seems maybe important.
There is
there's a global market clearing for collateral, and this seems very different from the role, prominent role played by intermediaries and dealers.
That's right, and we have, you know, we have this stylized example in the paper, which I did not have time to discuss. So where we put these 1,000 agents, and we form three groups of them, like 30, 30, 30. They can like trade among each other without restrictions, but between the groups only through an intermediary. And then the allocation looks like structurally quite similar as the theory predicts, but there has no like. Nothing like convergence to what the equilibrium theory would predict. So this intermediation destroys quite a lot in our example. So you need more thinking about that.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.